Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 36. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. As always, a huge thank you to the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so very grateful for each and every one of you. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before the end of June, and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. June's prize is a copy of Owen, Book 1 of the Tudor Trilogy by Tony Riches. A huge thank you to Tony for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Check out his other great books at tonyriches.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm delighted that joining me on the show to talk about historical fiction, Henry VIII and his queen consorts, is Alison Weir. Alison is the top-selling female historian in the United Kingdom and has sold over 2.7 million books worldwide. She's published 18 history books, including Elizabeth the Queen, The Lady in the Tower and Elizabeth of York, and 7 historical novels. Her latest biography is Queens of the Conquest, and her latest novel is Anna of Cleve, Queen of Secrets, the 4th in her 6 Tudor Queen series. My conversation with Alison straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song Robin's Sweet is from Carlene's new album entitled Elizabeth.
Robin sweet, my kiss, but do not ask my hand. Robin, sweet, oh how you ask too much of me. Is love not love without a wedding band?
Welcome to Talking Tudors, Alison. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Natalie?
I'm well. After some internet issues, I'm well now that we've been able to connect. Now, Alison.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, that's right. It's such an honour to have you on the show. Now, I don't know if you remember this, but the first time that I interviewed you for my website on the Tudor Trail was actually in 2010.
That's terrifying.
Isn't it terrifying?
I can't believe it's that long ago. Of the Berlin Festival, was it?
Oh, it may have been, or maybe it was the next year, because I remember we met in that year, which was wonderful.
We did, yeah, that's right, yes.
It's been a long time, I know, and time just flies, which is amazing. Now,
it's terrifying.
I know. Alison, while I imagine that most people who have an interest in the Tudors have heard of you and know of your many excellent fiction and non-fiction books, I would just love it if you could share with us a little bit about your background and how you came to be interested in history and the Tudors.
Right. Well, when I was 14, my mother marched me into a library and said, get a book, because I'd graduated from books to comics. And I got this rather lurid historical novel called Henry's Golden Queen. Uh-huh. I knew very little about the Tudors and or virtually nothing. And I devoured it in 2 days. Right. And it was a bit naughty for its time. And I thought, goodness me, did people really go on like that in those days? And rushed off to the history books at my school, which had a fantastic library, and found out, yes, they did. And I was looking to see what the facts were behind the fiction. And I'm still looking now, all these years later.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think that will ever stop, to be honest.
I don't think it will. No. Goodness.
All right, so a book, basically a story and a book, inspired your love of the Tudors.
Yes, it did. I know a lot of people come to history through fiction, and then serious study comes later.
Definitely, absolutely. Now, your debut Tudor novel was, hopefully I've got this right, The Innocent Traitor, a novel of Lady Jane Grey.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and that was published in 2006. But by that time, you'd already written and released 10 non-fiction books. So
I know.
That's amazing. So what inspired you to sort of turn your hand to fiction?
Well, when I was a teenager and, you know, had this new passion for history, I tried writing all sorts of things, plays, poetry, I did family trees, genealogy is a huge passion, and also historical research. But I also wrote a few novels, or I should say attempted to write a few novels, because I wouldn't like anyone to read them today. But there are a few examples of that early work on my website for fun, basically.
Okay, great.
When I was in 1998, I was researching Eleanor of Aquitaine, and I already had a huge body of research. So I actually had some leisure time, and I thought that for fun, I was going to write a novel, because I often do projects that aren't anything to do with my professional life. And that's when I get the time. So I wrote this novel. I didn't know if I could write fiction, and it was about Lady Jane Grey. And when I finished it, I quite liked it. And I had intended to submit it for publication, but I showed it to my agent. And he said, it's a riveting story, but it's faction. You've got to come off the fence, stop being a historian, and start being a novelist. And so I put it in a drawer and forgot about it.
Right.
a couple of years on, I took it out again and had another, no, but longer than that, actually, about 6 years on, I took it out again and had another look at it and rewrote it first person, present tense, with, wait for it, 16 narrators. It's, wow. It was edited down to 8. And that was the book that effectively was, it was commissioned by Hutchinson. And I was, nobody was more surprised than I was, because I just didn't know if I could write fiction, and clearly I couldn't to start with.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Now, Alison, I'm glad that we're talking about the fiction, because there is this sort of ongoing debate about how factual historical fiction should be.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's a never-ending debate, and you can get involved in it on Twitter if you'd like to. If you had time, exactly. Now, one of our lovely listeners and one of my wonderful patrons, Taylor, she's got an excellent question for you. She'd love to hear your opinion on what responsibility you think historical fiction writers have to the individuals they're writing about. Should they be trying to paint a truthful picture of the past? And do you think that misrepresentation of individuals in fiction can change the way these people are actually perceived by the general population, you know, for decades and even centuries to come?
Right. Well, first of all, I do very strongly think that historical novelists have some responsibility. You are writing about people who really lived.
Yes.
And what's the point of writing about their story if you're not going to tell it as accurately and truthfully as you can? But of course, when we're looking at history, we're looking at the evidence we actually have. It's the evidence we don't have that leaves a gap. And there, then you can use your imagination. But even then, I think that what you write should be credible in the context of what is known.
Yes.
Have I answered all those questions? Because there were three.
I asked you a lot of things at the same time. I think you have. Yeah, I think it can. You know, I'm with you. I think there you should have a responsibility to the person you're writing about, and that it can paint a picture that lasts. And we've seen it, haven't we? We've seen, you know, people that have cast one way or the other for hundreds of years.
A lot of people don't make a leap from historical fiction or films, or don't get me on films, to actual history. And I see it again and again. And I see people asking me questions at events. I'm thinking, where does this come from? You know, it's not documented. And they've got it from fiction.
Yes.
Or they got it from the television, from a television series or something like that. Yeah. And that does worry me, because, fiction is far more widely enjoyed than history. Mm. And these ideas become disseminated. But what I think you do, I wouldn't make up a storyline in one of my novels unless there was some even slender evidence to support it. Yeah. And I would write a very long author's note at the back of the book, giving the facts and just, or the evidence, and justifying what I've written. And I feel that's very important to have that, because I do know from, I do a lot of events, and people do care that what they read in historical fiction is close to the truth.
Yeah,
they want to be able to rely on it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the author's note is a fantastic practice. And I think it'd be great if more authors did that as well.
Because otherwise people just think, I'm reading a fictionalised version of the truth.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And some people would say you shouldn't even write historical fiction in that way. But, you know, some have an even stronger view. But I think it's a way of bringing it to life for people and trying to be as honest as possible when you're interpreting it, and to explain where you have deviated from the path or what you've invented to fill the gaps. Then I think it's okay.
Yeah, and historical fiction, I think, is so important, because, as you say, so many people come to love this period of history, you know, from that avenue. And then a lot of people now pursue other areas of research after it. So I think it's a great thing. Yeah, I think it's a great thing.
Oh, they do. They do. I mean, sometimes I get somebody writing to me saying, I read your novel, I'm now studying history. And I think, oh my goodness, that's wonderful. If it made one change to someone's life, it really makes me feel it's worth it.
Yeah, that is fantastic. Now, Alison, I'd love it if you could talk to us about your 6 Tudor Queen series of novels. Now, another one, when I actually posted on our little Talking Tudors Facebook group that I was talking to, and you have so many fans, so many that people all wanted, you know, they want, oh, can you ask this? Can you ask? So I'm doing my best. This one's for Lorna, and she would love to know more about that series, but she'd also in particular love to know how long it takes you to actually write one of these books.
Right, well, the series came about almost by accident because I published back in 1991, I published a book called The Six Wives of Henry VIII.
Yes.
It's out of date now, and for some years I've been re-researching and actually rewriting it. My publishers want to republish. It's been they're talking about six biographies, right. Not just one book.
Gosh.
Because it's so long now.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when I originally researched that back in the 1970s, it was 1,024 pages, not double-spaced. So there's a hell of a lot of material that did not get into that biography.
Right.
And I've gone back and had another look at some of that. And I've re-researched again. And of course, lots of new research has been done since I published Six Wives, by me and by quite a lot of other historians. So I've drawn on that for this new narrative. But it occurred to me, I was sitting in my agent's office in the October 2014. We were discussing ideas for future novels.
Yes.
And talking about a trilogy of novels on Richard III. And I'm thinking, do I really want to live with Richard III for the next few years? And I suddenly this idea came to me, six novels on the wives of Henry VIII. And I thought, no one's going to take, you know, six novels. No publisher will commission that many.
Mm.
So, but I said to my agent, I said, I've had another idea. And he said, oh, yes, what is it? And I didn't tell him it was in the seconds before, because I just knew in that moment it was right for me.
Yes.
I wanted to do this.
Yeah.
And his eyes lit up when I told him. I've never forgotten that moment. His eyes lit up and he said, well, I know that he had a 13-year-old daughter. And he said, I know which one of those series my daughter would like to read.
Right.
And I know which one publishers will want. And I thought, well, they're not going to take it because the market's glutted. Well, you know, Natalie, you know how popular Lynn is, for example.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
But so I thought no one's going to take this because, it's a ploughed field. But they did. In fact, there was competition for it. And I didn't realise when I was going around with my agent to publishers that they were showcasing themselves. I thought I was selling the books.
Right. That's amazing.
They really wanted it. So headline to my delight over here, and then Ballantyne, my established publisher in the States, commissioned the series. And it was such an exciting time. So the new research, the new theories do underpin the novels. And that's why there are quite extensive author's notes at the back.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. What a wonderful story. I absolutely love that. So for one of, just to get back to the time, because people like to know roughly how long it was different. It's different, I suppose, for the different novels.
Well, because I've done so much research, I mean, I know my way around the sources, I know my way around the story,
absolutely,
but of course the story does change. And so what I do essentially is spend some months fictionalising, lifting out the account. I've lifted the account out of the revised Six Wives,
mm-hmm.
added in new research, and then with a base historical text, I have fictionalised it as I go through. So I know I'm keeping to the historical text. And the sources.
Wonderful. Now, I am in absolute awe of her. Sorry, continue, Alison.
It takes about 4 months to write.
Right, okay. And that's, of course, because you've done all that work already.
It's there for you. So all you're doing is cherry picking all the way through what you're going to use, because each novel has to be written from each queen's point of view.
Mm.
And therefore, you have to ask yourself, would they have known this, you know?
Yes.
And huge chunks of it, like for Catherine Howard, for example, she is stuck away in Sion Abbey after she's been arrested and has left Hampton Court.
Yep.
She doesn't know what's going on with these interrogations behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
She's isolated. So that you're getting rid of, deleting vast swathes of material. In other cases, you're inventing material.
Wow, what an amazing journey.
It gives a different perspective.
It does, yes, exactly. Now, I'm just in absolute awe of how you manage to write fiction and non-fiction at times simultaneously. I think you're amazing. So how do you manage the research process in those situations where you're doing separate projects and one's a non-fiction, one's a fiction? How do you manage your time as well?
Well, the thing is, I mean, I'm writing concurrently, don't ask, a quartet of non-fiction books on England's medieval queens. I'm working on the second now, having delivered Catherine Howard. And I could only do this if I didn't have a huge bank of research that was done many years ago, which obviously has to be updated. But it's basically transcriptions of original sources, which I spent the 70s and much of some of the 60s in libraries transcribing.
Right.
So I've got a huge bank of this research. And so I'm using that. I've wanted to write this series. It's my largest bank of research that I haven't yet written up and published. So I've wanted to do it for many years, and we decided it was too much for one book.
Right.
So I'm doing it in four. So that's the reason I can do it. And I can do the six Tudor Queens novels because I have done so much research on, you know, rewriting that book.
And so you write every day, or do you have a day off where you just...
I start the year writing, I write office hours every day, and right, I start the year writing 5 days a week, and then it gets panic stricken, and sometimes it gets to the stage it's 7 days a week.
Oh, goodness. Okay. So another one of our lovely listeners would love to know if there's been a tutor figure that you've written about and then, you know, your initial opinion of that person has changed after you've done some research or spent some time away from them and come back to them.
I can't say that my opinion has changed. I can't think of a single Tudor figure about whom my opinion has changed. If it's anyone, it would be Richard III. Yes, that was the most likely thing when I did research on him. I can't say it's changed in small ways, you know, but not generally. Maybe going back many years, Anne Boleyn, because I had a very romanticised view of her as the youngsters too, you know. Yeah. And I came round to a rather different view after doing the research.
Right. Okay.
That's years.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And that does happen. It evolves and changes, doesn't it, as we learn more as well.
It does. Yes. But the general view does that. It's still the same impression.
Okay.
Of the character.
All right, thank you. Now, in 2009, you released a book called The Lady in the Tower, The Fall of Anne Boleyn.
Yes.
So, Alison, I have to ask, I think now it's not the million-dollar question, I think it's the billion-dollar question. Why did she have to die? Why did she have to die? What's your thought on that?
Well, I go with Eric Ives on this, that I think Cromwell saw her as an enemy. She made it quite clear she was an enemy. It was going to be his neck or hers. Mm-hmm. So he took her out, and he stuck his neck out to do it, literally. Oh, God, sorry about the pun. But
he did.
Henry was so sensitive and suggestible about treason. And I think he knew, I think it was because she had such a poor reputation, the state papers are littered with slanders and libels and things, it was credible to put these charges forward. Mind you, it's slightly incredible, the number of charges. Mm. And if you analyse it, of course, as you well know, we can prove that some of these acts of adultery didn't happen.
Absolutely.
So it's because it was all done with such speed. And Henry's reaction is quite unusual, actually. This really knocks him sideways. And you can tell that on the day of Anne Boleyn's, there's a tournament at Greenwich on the 1st of May.
Yes.
And Henry is given information. And Sir Henry Norris is arrested, and the king goes to Whitehall from Greenwich. And he rides with Sir Henry Norris and questions him himself. That is virtually unprecedented because treason, the king is the Lord's anointed. He mustn't be tainted by any breath of treason. So why would he interrogate himself a suspected traitor? It's a knee-jerk reaction. He has to know. This is a man he's trusted. And he doesn't appear in public. You don't see him. Whereas with Catherine Howard, yes, he is. After she's arrested, he's gutted. But he does appear. You do see him.
Okay. So your impression or...
I think my view that Cromwell is the one. He later told Chapuis, he said he was the people's prime mover in the matter.
So I know the source you're talking about.
The queen, you know, in which he had taken a great deal of trouble.
Yes, exactly. Now, so you're of the belief that Henry believed Anne was guilty and that Cromwell
I think he did, yes. Mm. Because, I mean, he was quite open later on. He said about regretting it, having Cromwell executed.
Oh, yes.
Never did he express any regret for having Anne executed.
Mm. Wow, it's such an intriguing tale, even all those centuries after.
Go on and on this.
Yes, exactly. A whole episode just on the downfall. All right. So another one of our great listeners, Jessica, she'd like to know whether you feel that jousting accident that occurred in January 1536 actually did cause some sort of traumatic brain injury, or do you think this is Henry from the very beginning?
It worries me that people have this perception because the source for this, that he lay without speaking for 2 hours, is Rodolfo Pio, the papal nuncio in Paris. Mm-hmm. And he's very unreliable on Anne Boleyn's arrest and fall, which is only, you know, 4 months later.
Yes.
And he says her women, her father were arrested with her. He's unreliable as a witness. Mm. English sources state, or sources in England state, that the king took no hurt.
Yes.
Yeah, but everybody was worried because they thought he had died. Mm. Now, Chapuis, for example, would have picked up on this like any, you know, very quickly. He had very good sources close to the court. He would have picked up on it. Other people would. If Henry had been out conscious for 2 hours, somebody else would have mentioned it.
Yeah.
I think. And also, there's no sudden change in Henry in 1536. If you look at a trajectory of all the source material in the years leading up to that, you can see it's a gradual progression of this, deterioration of his character. I mean, morally, perhaps, or, you know, he just changes. He becomes nastier, you know, in a more present tempers. And it took a long while for this to happen. And I think everybody was really shocked. I mean, through the great matter, I think it's frustration that makes Henry what he is. Frustration at not having a son, at Catherine of Aragon's obstinacy, at the Pope withholding an annulment for what Henry sees as political reasons, and at not being able to consummate his passion for Anne. And I think all of these make him, you know, really frustrated, and he takes that out. That comes out in other ways. And when he finally executes someone in the Great Matter, which is the Nun of Kent and her supporters, everybody's shocked. And this reign of terror that follows with the Carthusians and Moore and Fisher in the following year, you can see that change then. This is before 1536. And there's no sudden change at all. He just continues in the same vein. He gets ever more sanctimonious because he's head of the church. And so I can't see that. I can't see that that works at all. I just don't think the evidence is reliable.
Okay, thank you. Now, Alison, apart from all these wonderful books that you write and all your research, you actually also run a tour company. I don't know if everyone knows that. So when did the tour company begin, and why did you start that company?
Right, I did a lecture program for the Smithsonian Institute in Washington when I was in the States on a book tour. And a lady approached me there she's one of America's leading travel agents. And she worked for the Smithsonian then, and she said they were trying to plan a Tudor tour because they have this company called Smithsonian Journeys of Enrichment. So they asked me if I would help. I ended up not only planning the tour, but leading it for them. And it was a very enjoyable experience. And when I finished, they wanted me to do it again and again and again. And I said, well, no, I really don't want to. In the end, they were offering me shares in it, in the profits.
Right.
But I said to I was talking to my agent about it, because he wasn't really involved in this initially. And he said, why don't you run your own tours? Found your own tour company. He said, I can use the company structure here, you know, for the legal, administrative, financial side.
Yeah.
And, you know, I brought in other people. I brought my uncle out of retirement because he'd spent his life in high-end group business travel. And, you know, he was really experienced. And then a historian friend, Siobhan Clark, she's a Tudor historian who works at historical palaces. And she also does the admin for us in customer care. So then we have four full-time historians on the tour now. That's myself, Sarah Griswood, Nicola Tallis, and Julian Humphreys. And then
amazing.
We have guest historians. We had Tracy Borman on the last tour for three nights. We just finished a tour, and Michael Jones for four or five nights. And then we've had lots of guest speakers, including Charles Spencer, David Starkey. I mean, you mention it.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes.
What a lineup. And you were in Scotland for the last one, weren't you? I think I saw some pictures.
It was amazing. Because of the distance, we couldn't have speakers coming in and out like a swing door. You know, it's expensive to do that. But we plan to do it. We're doing a Wolf Hall tour next year, and we're planning to do to have, you know, speakers coming just for one event on that as well.
Wonderful. And if people want to find out more, there's a website for the tour
company. AlisonWeTours.com. Yes.
Excellent. AlisonWeTours.com. And we'll add a link to that in the show notes so people can access that nice
and easily. We only do one or two a year, and we've got I think we've got seven places left to sell in October next year, and that's it.
Right. Very popular. Okay, great. Now, you mentioned some books earlier, so you're currently working on some new books. Is that right, Alison?
Yes, I am, yes.
So they're that's the non-fiction series that you mentioned?
I'm working on the second one of the non-fiction series, which, because of my hectic schedule, had to be put back a year.
Yes.
So that's why I published Tudor Christmas with Siobhan Clark, which was meant to be a short project. But
it's a lovely book. I have that one. I love that one.
Enjoyed it, but it was a lot of setting for it, you know, and illustrations and all that kind. It's more involved than I thought. Never done an illustrated book before.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful looking book, isn't it?
I think they produced it really nicely. So yes, I'm doing England's Medieval Queens 2 at the moment. That's early Plantagenet queens from Eleanor of Aquitaine to Eleanor of Castile.
Fantastic. And so the release dates for those, when are they sort of?
Well, we're talking about it at the moment. At present, it's autumn next year. But there was some talk of putting it back to the following February. But this is all very much in its infancy. And I think that's going to interfere with my writing schedule. So I'm discussing it with my agent at the moment. But hopefully autumn next year.
Wonderful. So watch this space, I think, is the message there. And I don't know how you do it. You also do talks, don't you? You give a lot of talks during the year.
Oh, 70 events the year before last. And about 45, I think, now for Anna of Clever.
So, goodness me.
Yes. So, yes, it's busy. I'm just off for today for 4 days on a book tour, and then I've got a holiday next week, thank goodness.
Oh, well, that's amazing. That is lovely. It's always good to get a little R&R in there somewhere.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
All right. Fabulous, Alison. It's been so lovely chatting with you. We are up to
and
that time.
You.
Thank you. We are up to that time of playing our little game that I like to call 10 to go. So these are just sort of 10 fun questions for our listeners to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready?
I am.
Fabulous. So what's something you love about where you live?
The peace and quiet here. I live in a quiet cul-de-sac with lots of green outside, and that's what I love.
Oh, that does sound really lovely and perfect for writing as well.
Yeah.
What's your favourite season?
I think spring, with that burgeoning of, you know, of nice weather, of blossom on the trees and that. But it's very hard to answer that, actually, because I also like autumn with that sense of something brewing in the air with Christmas coming ahead.
Oh, yes. Lovely. Okay. Thank you. So what was the last film you watched? Do you have time to watch any films? I don't know.
Gosh, I'm trying to remember the last film I watched. Oh, gosh, I sat with my son, who showed me a Walt Disney film, would you believe?
That's about, lovely.
I can't even remember the name of it now. Moani or something like that.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. But
that's all right.
He loves it. Like that.
Nice to spend time together. So what is, not a film that you've recently watched, but what's one of your favourite Tudor-themed films or series?
Ah, now you've asked me. I think probably of all the Tudor films, it would be the Henry VIII and His Six Wives with Keith Michelle. I watched that long ago and was struck by how well it was done.
Yes.
Brilliantly well acted, well dressed. They don't dress them like that now.
No.
Compared to the Tudors.
Yeah.
And there's no comparison.
Yeah, that's so true. I do love the costumes in those films.
And Keith Michelle's interpretation of Henry VIII was wonderful. Yeah. I think he's the best screen Henry ever.
Yeah, I haven't watched that one in a long time, actually. I think I should revisit
it. Watch it again.
One.
You'll be struck by it.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. So you mentioned you're going on a holiday. What's a favourite holiday destination for you?
Well, river cruising in Europe,
which
we love. And that's what I'm doing this year. I've done a lot of the European rivers and I'm quite happy to do the same one again because I love the life on board. It's very relaxing, just what I need. But with excursions, you know, you get to see things. Food's fantastic. I go with a group of family and we sit there having card tournaments. We don't bet, but we just enjoy the competition.
Lovely. That sounds lovely. Now, what's one book that you've got on your bedside table at the moment, Alison?
Oh, no, I'm trying to remember who wrote it. It's called Whispers. It's a ghost story. And I'm trying to remember who. Oh, something Goodwin.
Oh, that sounds
I think.
Good.
Rosie Goodwin, I think.
Okay.
It's a ghost story. And I love ghost stories.
Yeah,
just
me too.
Peter James, The House on Cold Hill. That was an amazing book. So I love ghost stories. I actually write them. I'm hoping to publish a collection one day.
Oh, I'd love that. I love ghost stories too. Speaking of which, that leads nicely into another question. Have you ever, I know you do a lot of travelling and you visit a lot of historical sites. Have you ever had any spooky experiences at any of these?
Yes, I have. There's an old hall house in Lavenham in Suffolk, which is a beautiful old town. And it's been divided. It was a hall house. It's been divided at some point with a floor put in into the hall to make it two rooms.
Right.
And I went there on a blazing hot summer's day in 1976, a very hot summer. And it was a lovely day. And I walked in. There were two ladies sitting in the hall, just giving out, you know, you paid your entrance to them. There was no one else. And I wandered around downstairs. I went upstairs. And at the top of the stairs, to my left, is the door into the upper part of this divided hall. And it's a white, all whitewashed with beams, very high, with just chests along the walls, a wooden floor and little red curtains at the windows. Mm. I took two steps into that room and couldn't go any further.
Mm.
It was just something terrifying. Yeah. There was some reason. I just fled. And I fled along the corridor and came to a dead end. And I had to go back and I had to walk past that door. And I did it with my eyes closed.
Wow.
Now, I went back a few years later, quite a few years later, and asked. I told the people in the house what had happened. They said no one else had ever reported anything like that. So probably my formidable imagination, I would think. But I thought didn't like that feeling at all.
Wonderful. I love that story. Now, what is one of your earliest childhood memories?
Sitting in my pram at the end of the hall waiting to go out. And it was a big one of these big bassinet type prams. And I can remember sitting there with reins attaching me at the side. And I can just remember my mother and my grandmother getting ready to go out. That's my earliest memory. I must have been under two.
Quite early. That's great. What's your favourite cuisine? If you're eating out, what do you like to have?
Italian. Love it.
Yum, me too.
It's always like a magnet.
Yeah, I'm an Italian fan, definitely. What about music? What music do you like to listen to?
I love a huge spectrum of music, from classical to rock. I love The Killers. I love Roxy Music, David Bowie, and also a lot of early music, which I collect.
Right. Yes, I love it.
I love anything like that. I'm sure you do. Tudor and Renaissance music.
Oh, beautiful, yes.
David Monroe's stuff. I mean, he committed suicide a long time ago, his stuff was wonderful. He was the first to really realise that and make it popular.
Right, okay. Yes, I find that music so atmospheric. I love it. Lucky last question of our 10 questions. Alison, do you have any advice for aspiring historians? I know lots of our listeners, you know, they want to become historians, they want to become writers. Do you have any advice for them?
I do, yes. Never give up.
Yeah.
That's the basic advice I would give. Also, listen to what people are telling you. Take advice. Mm-hmm. If you get a lot of rejections, you're quite entitled to ask why.
Yes.
You may get a woolly answer. But if you do keep getting rejections, either look again at your writing or wonder if the project is right for this publisher or for the Times. And perhaps go on a writing courses, that kind of thing. You know, seek advice. Because people do send me quite a lot of stuff they'd like to submit, and as my agent says, you can usually tell very quickly whether it's publishable.
Right. Yeah.
But remember that agents and publishers make up their minds within about the first paragraph as to whether this book is going to be published. So grab them there, or if you're going to do a gentle opening, then make sure it's really compelling.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great advice. Thank you. Now, we're up to our last little thing, which I love. It's the Tudor takeaway. So a little something for our listeners to take away with them that might help deepen their understanding of the Tudor period or just simply nurture their love of this fascinating era. Do you have a Tudor takeaway, Alison?
I do indeed. Yay. And it's a website. And it's a website of the Institute of Historical Research. And it's worldwideweb.british-history.ac.uk. That's ac.uk.
Yes, ac.uk.
And that you yourself will probably know this website, Natalie, but it's a website where a lot of the original sources for the period are transcribed. For example, the letters and papers of the reign of Henry VIII, the diplomatic calendars, the Victoria County histories. It's a huge mine of information, and it's got a search facility. But beware, because some of the entries are given in their original spelling. So, for example, when I was looking up William Carey, when I was writing about Mary Boleyn, the name Carey is given in many, many different forms. K-A-R-R-E-E, which doesn't really help.
No, it doesn't.
Actually, when you go through those sources, you have to go through the whole lot. But it's a wonderful website. So many out-of-date sources on it. There's a wealth of information on there.
That's a wonderful, wonderful Tudor takeaway. And I'll have the link to that so we can find that easily as well. And thank you for just reminding us about the spelling, because I had the exact same thing happen to me, and I learned that very quickly, that before you have to read it all, don't you, basically?
Yes, you do.
There's no shortcut there. All right. Well, Alison, I know we're into your writing time, so I'm so grateful that you've made time to chat with me today. And I know that all our listeners are going to absolutely love it. So I thank you very much for talking Tudors with me.
And thank you so much for inviting me, Natalie. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.